We all know we're living in a time of wars and rumors of wars. War rages in Afghanistan. The recent news you've heard, of course, is that some of these Al-Qaeda and Taliban people are offering what would be equivalent to 1 year's salary to those people over there for every American trooper they either capture or kill. They've also offered large sums of money for the capture or murder of any Western journalist. You know recently what happened when a group of these suicide people, well, they actually didn't commit suicide, but they went in with grenades and guns blazing and murdered a group of nominal Christians in Pakistan. You know that American forces are in the Philippines. You know that American forces are now in Yemen. You know that there was big debate on the news just today about whether America should become involved by sending troops over to help out Israel in some way or another, which is really a stupid idea, and I'll talk about that maybe a little later. But we all know that war is raging. There is already, or has been, an attempted overthrow of Karzai's interim government in Afghanistan. So already a large pocket of people, a large group of people, got together and were trying to form a coup to overthrow the interim government. Do you think there is going to be peace in Afghanistan? You think there's going to be peace in Pakistan? Will there be peace in Israel? Will peace break out in the Middle East? Will it be peace in our time? Now, if you're not concerned, you ought to be. There are very few young people here in our midst. I know my grandson, Mark, my son Mark, is concerned about his son. There is no remote inkling that the federal government intends to impose another draft. But do not think that that could not become possible if America becomes so strapped for military forces by becoming involved in so many parts of the world that we simply do not have anywhere near the armed forces to contribute to all of these various trouble spots. What I want to say is that we all know what Matthew 24 says. Well, all of us know pretty much by heart what Luke 21 says. We know the prophecies of Jesus Christ. But are we doing what Jesus Christ says we are to do about it? Are we reacting in the way he says we are to react? If you look at Matthew 24, 6 to 8, he says, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars." Well, that's all we hear about. Now, the wars that are raging right now are primarily in Afghanistan, in Israel, and little minor guerrilla wars here and there around the world. But another major one that could break out that they're constantly talking about because of the so-called axis of evil and continual pressure in the media from governmental statements which lead you to believe that an attack against Iraq is in the offing. I thought maybe not before May, and I based that merely upon my own personal assessment of how long it would take some of the major contractors to provide all the laser-guided missiles and the bombs and all of that that would be required, because I knew we'd drawn down our inventory near to the bottom in our avalanche of explosive force that we unleashed against Pakistan, I should say Afghanistan, and I know it would take a long time to build those back up again. Maybe it won't even be by May. It may be June or a little later. It depends upon how much logistical support they need to marshal before they do that. But you can look for that in the future. And you know what that's going to mean. Over 1.2, 1.3 billion Muslims all over the world who are already frantically and just insanely enraged against the United States. They're calling for jihad all over the Islamic world. Iran is calling for every Muslim to resist Israel, to destroy it. And by the way, the Palestinian Authority is now saying that they are going to pass out bomb belts. They're saying anyone that wants to come up and strap on a bomb belt to go and blast himself and anybody else around him or her to bits can have one. I was telling my wife this morning, why don't the people trying to pass them out strap them on? But they send the young fanatics out to do it for them. So, and that's what you're going to hear tonight. It's what you're going to hear tomorrow. And sending Colin Powell over there isn't going to do a bit of good. And we'll talk about Yasser Arafat in a minute. But he says, "You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled." Now, in one sense, I think God's people take that a little bit too literally. Because a lot of people aren't a bit troubled. And when I say, troubled, in my sense, I'm really addressing it from a different point of view than Jesus did. He meant not to be completely upset or distressed, not to be frightened, but he didn't mean don't be alert or watching or concerned. Because he says, watch you therefore, that these things do not come upon you unawares. And he lays out exactly all of the events that we can expect to happen before the time that he called the tribulation, the day of the Lord, and the second coming of Christ. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Why doesn't God just stop it? Right now, here and there and everywhere, in Palestinian territory, in the refugee camps in southern Lebanon, among the Hamas and the Black September and the Hezbollah and all the rest of them, there are people together who are plotting. They are planning. They've got their maps out. They've got their photographs. They've got their information. They've got their financing. And they're talking about the exact time and the place and the date where they're going to go and perpetrate some other act of terrorism. You know that, don't you? Right here in the United States, perhaps within less than 100 miles of where we are right now, there are people doing the very same thing. There are cadres and little groups here and there which have not been found out among the millions of people, really, foreigners, and over a million illegal immigrants into the United States, and only a matter of a very few thousand INS officials who were doing an abominable, abysmal job anyway, that are required to ferret them out and find out where they are. Do you know that there's an Islamic cultural center in Tyler, Texas, for example? Well, there is. Now, I'm sure we all feel that it is completely benign, right? We just want to believe that it's a religion of turn the other cheek and love your enemies and all of that, and there's just nothing going on inside that Islamic mosque where they have their meetings and they skid to their knees and their foreheads five times a day. I like to think that those 14 young pilots buzzing around and have been for about 13 weeks now, learning to fly in a Cessna 172, allegedly to go back to join their national airlines in Algeria and begin flying 767s, which is stupid all by itself, as I've talked about before, are just real nice young Algerian students who wanted to come to the United States instead of France, which is in a sense their mother country that really colonized and controlled Algeria for so many decades, or anywhere else in Europe where they could have gone to any number of hundreds of flight schools, but instead they're in Tyler, Texas. So when I have sent one email after another to the federal government, to the INS, to the FBI, to the CIA, and have called the local sheriff, have sent emails to the FBI, left a voice message on the FBI telephone, and have never received a single response to any of those letters about my concern of immigrants from Algeria learning to fly, I wonder what's going to happen when one of those guys, a year or two or three from now, ends up driving an airplane, a big 767, into some huge high-rise office building in Houston or New York or Dallas-Fort Worth or somewhere else, and they identify him as one who learned to fly in Tyler, Texas. I wonder how the flight instructor, one of whom is a former worldwide minister, is going to feel when that occurs. Now, Jesus Christ knows about every one of those plots. God knows it all. God knows what is happening. His eyes behold everything that's going on. He is privy to the conversation right now in the mosques and in the cultural centers and in the various little safe houses and the hideouts and the caves or wherever else these rotten, filthy, rat-like finks hide out and plot what they're trying to do. And he hears what they're doing. He watches them as they strap on their bombs. He sees them as they get on the bus or the taxi. He knows right up to the moment of pulling the detonator what they're going to do. Do you deal with that? Why doesn't he stop it? Because God is not interfering in this world today. Because this is not God's world. The world has turned its back on God and has said, we don't want you interfering in our day-to-day lives. A lot of people come up with the idea, and I'll just address this real briefly, that God knows what you're going to do in the next 5 minutes. God knows what you're going to do this afternoon and tonight and tomorrow. If some of you believe that, let me disabuse you of that notion. I know it almost sounds blasphemous, but I've got to tell you the truth. God does not know what you're going to do tonight. And God does not know what you're going to do tomorrow or the next day. But doesn't the Bible say God knows everything? And doesn't He know the end from the beginning? And isn't He omniscient and omnipresent, all-seeing and everywhere present? So what am I doing, preaching false doctrine? Well, think about the example of Abraham. When did God know which way Abraham was going to go when He told Abraham to sacrifice his only son Isaac? He didn't know until Abraham had the knife in his hand and raised it up and was about to slit his own son's throat, did he? And He says, Abraham, hold it. There's a ram over there. So Abraham went and got the ram. And then the Bible says that God said to Abraham, now I know that you have not withheld your son, your only son, and that you really trust me, and so on. Now I know, not because God knew in advance, but because of the fact that Abraham had free choice, free moral agency, volition, and God did not know which way Abraham would go until Abraham made the decision. So let's dispense with the idea that God knows everything you're going to do. He knows you're going to turn that corner, you're going to go in that room, you're going to drive that car. If that were true, then God is the accomplice in every automobile accident, in every murder, every robbery, every rape, and everything else that goes on, because He could prevent it. All right, well, enough of that. I want to just throw that in there because that had come up not too long ago. Over then in Matthew 24, where we were, see that you be not troubled. I'm saying that means not to be frantic, not to be in fear of your life or in fear of losing salvation. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. Have you noticed an increase in earthquakes? There have been a couple of really bad ones, a very big one right over there in Afghanistan. And it was a big one. It did minimal damage as far as human life is concerned, but tore up an awful lot of property in Iran just yesterday. Right there in the Middle East, where the wars are raging, all of a sudden you've got earthquakes accompanying it. All these are the beginning of sorrows. It has just begun. I remind you that when the crown prince of the Austro-Hungarian Empire was assassinated in an open touring car in the streets of Sarajevo clear back in 1916 or 17, that triggered World War I, but only after a series of other events. When Hitler decided to march into the Rhineland, and some of the people greeted him with putting little flowers in the barrels of the German rifles that came in there, Britain and France and all the Western allies could have stood up to him and prevented it and actually kicked him back out. And he'd even told his troops when he marched across the bridge, if you receive any kind of hostile fire, turn around and come back the other way. But the bluff worked. And so when he marched into the Rhineland, it emboldened him to demand the Sudetenland, where there were 3 million ethnic Germans in the extreme western part of what was then Czechoslovakia. And then that was the end of his demand, so he told Chamberlain. And when Chamberlain, of course, Anschluss had occurred and Austria had been annexed and Hitler was just gobbling up territory, and Chamberlain came back and said, it is peace in our time. Well, then the Battle of Britain waged when Britain went to war for all the wrong reasons, because they had absolutely guaranteed Poland that if Hitler attacked Poland, they would attack Germany. And Hitler did attack Poland, but there was more to it than that. There was the enigma and the ultra-secret and that enigma machine that had been surreptitiously taken out of Poland, out of a hotel there by an exchange of bags. It's quite an interesting story that is told in the book called A Man Called Intrepid. And so Britain went to war, and what did America do? Nothing. We sat here. When the Battle of Britain was waging, and when was being, waged or raging, and when there were bombs falling all over London, including they just now are burying the Queen Mum, and talked about the fact that she and King George were inside Buckingham Palace when bombs hit a portion of it, and they did not go to Canada, like many other people urged them to do, but stayed right there, which earned her quite a bit of admiration during World War II. America did nothing. Matter of fact, we had German Bunds. Herman Hayes' father was a member of one in Los Angeles, marching with swastikas on and screaming Nazi slogans. There was the America First movement was very, very viable in New York and big cities in the East, where there were tens of thousands of American Nazis who believed in what Hitler was doing, who were anti-Semites, who were racial or white superior racists, and they believed in what Hitler was trying to do. It wasn't until Japan bombed Pearl Harbor that our FBI, who had taken careful note to notice who all these people are, started rounding up a lot of these people inside the United States. And America went to war December 7, 1941, when the war had broken out over 2 years before that, and the actual rumblings of war were 3.5 to 4 years old by that time. So don't think that September 11th, 2001, was not a major triggering event atop which other events are now being superposed and occurring that are going to lead toward war, which will become regional, which will eventually become global. Because all nations are getting involved. Europe is issuing every kind of a scathing indictment. They've already said that the United States' attempt to broker peace in the Middle East has failed, and that Europeans need to go down there and do it. Well, they tried it. They sent a few people down there, and the Israelis just snubbed them. Now, as I say that, let me just talk to the fact that just this morning on Fox and Friends, they were debating the issue, and they asked the question so people could call in about, should the United States send troops to Israel? You know, if stupidity were like, say, smallpox, and people could break out in a rash for being stupid, a tremendous percentage of the American population would run around with just purple splotches all over their body. They'd just be splotched from head to foot. And this one lady called in, yes, I think we should send troops over there, and so on. I thought, well, you stupid lady. How can you be? How can anyone? Well, how can the media even ask the question in the first place? Who and what is Israel? It's a sovereign nation. It is a democracy. It is armed to the teeth with hundreds, if not thousands, of nuclear weapons. It has many, many hundreds of tanks. It has hundreds of aircraft. It has an air force, has a navy, has an army. It has all the other agencies. It is a nation. And these people, they said, well, we would be enmeshed in like another Vietnam. Doing, boing, dum, dum. We went over to Vietnam because a foreign nation was actually trying to take over southern Vietnam, and it was merely being sponsored by the communist Chinese as well as the Russians. And of course, it was a whole different situation. Southern Vietnam didn't have the kind of power, didn't have the A-bomb, didn't have an air force, an army, and a navy, and all of that that the rest did. And we were there to try to actually save a nation. There's this, I think the one woman that called actually acted like she thought, well, if we didn't help little old Israel out, those nasty Palestinians were going to just destroy Israel. So that's why I'm telling you, I think some people ought to break out in purple splotches. They just don't know what in the world they're talking about. So, take a look now at Matthew 24, 9 and 10. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. When? When all these other things that he just described, nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famines, pestilences, and earthquakes, all these are the beginning of sorrows. When those things begin to happen, then they will deliver you up to be afflicted. Now that did happen in type many, many centuries ago, but unless Jesus Christ knew what he was talking about, it's going to happen again. Now, whom did they deliver up to be afflicted, and why, and who would it be who would be hated of all men for the sake of the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth? Does that mean Muslims hating Catholics? No. Why would they hate someone for the sake of the name of Jesus Christ? Now, right now, there is a struggle, and you're all aware that there are some 100 people holed up in a huge, big complex, which includes living quarters, cooking, eating, sleeping quarters, and includes the big church that is built on what they think was the site, and they're probably wrong, of the manger in which Jesus Christ was born. They have holy by degrees, you know, in the Islamic religion and the Christian religion and so on, like the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock are like the second and the third holiest. So when you go in there, you think, well, I'm only a third as holy as I would be if I were in Mecca. And however they do, I don't know. But this is one of the holiest sites of nominal Christianity. And the Pope has already gotten involved. You heard that the other day the Pope spoke out in his quavering voice against the violence, and he too is telling the Israelis that they need to withdraw from all the cities where they've sent their tank columns and are trying to fair up some of these terrorist cells. Europe is demanding they withdraw. Now, day before yesterday, President George Bush made the same very strong statement that he basically demanded that Israel withdraw. And today, when he was meeting with Tony Blair right down here in Texas, not more than a 2.5 hour drive from where we are, where he is right now, he said he wanted them to do it immediately, to withdraw. Now, that is a little bit of hypocrisy that sort of just annoys me. And I'll tell you why. We were attacked on September 11th, and we have sent our armed forces halfway around the world to go to war to exterminate thousands of these people, to obliterate and destroy a nation, rebuild a new country out of it, have an interim, do all of that. We got carrier battle groups over there. We got great big Air Force aircraft. We had sent our B-1 bomber and our stealth bombers, and we'd sent our B-52s out of Barksdale. We just drew down our inventory of bombs and missiles by blasting Afghans, and a lot of them were civilians, of course. That's just collateral damage. They like to put it that way. That's what war is all about. So we go half a world away in pursuit of terrorists, and because Israel goes 6 miles, 5 blocks, a mile and a half, 20 miles away to ferret out terrorists that are killing their people, blasting them in buses and discos and pizza parlors and restaurants and on the Passover massacre, our government has the gall to tell Israel that they shouldn't go after those terrorists, and at the same time, out of the other side of his mouth, say, we support Israel's war against terrorism. There's some things in politics you just find it hard to understand. Talking out of both sides of your mouth at once, just very, very difficult. Well, when you know why, when you know it's all about oil, it's all about hoping to patch together some kind of a weak coalition. We would like to have as many of the leading, quote-unquote, Arab nations, including especially Egypt, if we can. And if they'll just stay quiet, the corrupt, rotten regime in Saudi Arabia, to at least nominally stay out of it and not just pitch in and start to attack us if we attack Iraq. And because either Yemen or Iraq or both are on the next list of our federal government, our president and our government has got to make every kind of a soft, condescending statement that they possibly can to these insanely angry Arab states. And that's what it's all about. Politics is nothing but a pack of lies. It's one lie on top of another lie to conceal the first lie. Now, the Israelis went over there and they determined the house and the people who were there where the mastermind of the Passover massacre was holed up. And they just went in there and just blasted them all to bits. Now, the man who masterminded that massacre of innocent civilians on the night of their Seder, their Passover supper, has now been killed. Now the latest word you heard probably this morning or last night, the Palestinians have said, we will get revenge for that. Isn't it interesting? See, that they plot and they kill, and then you kill the killer, and they're going to get revenge for you killing the murderer of the Israeli people. It's incredible. It's an incredible world in which we live, and believe it or not, we will be involved a lot more than just wondering whether or not somebody's going to pollute the Los Angeles water supply or fly a light plane into one of our nuclear reactors or grab another 767 and slam it into the White House. We're going to be involved even more than that in the months and the years ahead. And it is for months and years. It's not just for days and weeks. It's going to be a protracted period of time into which we have already entered. We're not going to see in the next few months, world peace break out. You can just take that to the bank. We're not going to be living in a time of world peace. Maybe in little areas like Tyler, Texas, we will have comparative safety. But you know, Jesus said, when they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction shall be upon them. So he tells us never to back off and to relax and to just act like business as usual and pretend that none of this is real. Matthew 24, 12 to 14, he says, because iniquity shall abound, and that means lawlessness, the love of many shall wax cold. That's interesting, isn't it? Because of the lawlessness, the crime, and the violence around us, it causes the zeal, the love of many of God's people to just wane and to wax cold. And that certainly has been true in the church. I've seen a lot of that where there's a real lack of love. That's why I preached about it so much and so strongly and ask you every time when you analyze a situation to say, where's the love? Because oftentimes you look at people viciously attacking one another, a brother against a brother, sister against a sister, what have you, in the church, and you say, where's the love? Well, surely Jesus must have known what he was talking about. Because iniquity shall abound. It's all around us, and that's just the climate. And Satan the devil has come down having great wrath because he knows that he has but a short time. Love will wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, whether that is the end of his life or the end of the age, shall be saved. And this good news of the coming world-ruling government of God, to tell you what it really means, the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness, pardon me, unto all nations, and then shall the end come. Now, look at Luke 21, 21 to 24. Again, he's talking about the Great Tribulation, and he says, let them which were in Judea, and that was the old Roman province of Judea that includes Jerusalem as its capital, flee to the mountains, and let them which were in the midst of it depart out, and let not them that are in the countries enter thereinto. For these be the days of vengeance, that all things that are written may be fulfilled. But woe unto them that are with child, to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. There is not prophesied peace to break out in Israel. And we'll get to that in just a moment. They shall fall by the edge of the sword and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, not the Jews, but the Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. From the time of the 1967 Six-Day War, I don't know how familiar you are with the map of Israel. If you remember the way it looked then, with a real narrow waist, with a huge amount of what is called the West Bank, all the way to Latrun, only 12 miles to the Mediterranean, a narrow little corridor to the western or the Jewish half of Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip in Egypt's hands, all of the West Bank and the old city Jerusalem in Jordan's hands, the Golan Heights above the Sea of Galilee in Syria's hands, and the border with southern Lebanon, the Bekaa Valley right to the adjacent to that above the Sharon Valley and above Haifa. Now, during the unilateral declaration of independence for Israel 1948, the combined might of six Arab armies attacked Israel from all three sides. They lost. In 1956, combined Arab armies attacked Israel from three sides. They lost. In 1967, five Arab armies, this time far better armed, supplied by the Soviets, with Soviet T-34 tanks in Egypt and Soviet MiGs on Egyptian airfields, attacked Israel from three sides. They lost. And this time they lost big. The tank columns, some of them under men that I have met and talked to, including Yitzhak Rabin, who was a former and a late prime minister, whom I counted a personal friend, Moshe Dayan, the guy with the black eye patch. I spent the afternoon in his home and saw all of his collection of artifacts. He was a tank commander at the Mitlah Pass. They blasted those Egyptian tanks one after another until hundreds of them were burning hulks. The Israeli Air Force caught the Egyptian Air Force on the ground, and the pictures in Time magazine showed the incredible unerring accuracy of the Israeli Air Force to just blast those planes right where they sat. They won in the fourth major war in that region, territory that prior to that time, the Gaza Strip had been like a knife into their soft underbelly. The area to Latrun, only 12 miles, which would be traversed by a tank in exactly 30 minutes, was that close to the Mediterranean, which would have cut northern Israel from southern Israel right in two if the Jordanians and the Iraqis and the Saudi Arabians and everybody else who tried to do it had succeeded, which they didn't. And then they had to take the tank columns from there, put them on flatbeds, and get them all the way up to the northern part and start their march toward Kunetra, where they destroyed hundreds of Syrian tanks and the road to Damascus lay wide open. We were there a few months after that, and we got a rental car and we drove up to Kunetra. I drove up to the Golan Heights and I got down into some of the pillboxes and trenches and had my tape recorder and I was doing descriptive broadcasts of what was there, looking down at the Sea of Galilee. As we drove up to that area, there were big signs along the road that said, stay on the hard macadam, do not get off of it because there are mines. Believe me, we stayed in the middle of the road as often as we could. When we drove into Kunetra, there was a rubble-filled lot. There were all kinds of destroyed buildings and pockmarks in walls and all that. And there was a helmet lying upside down, a Syrian helmet, over there in that field, only about 60 yards from me. I got out of the car, and I thought, I'm going to run over there to get that. Then I stopped, and I thought, now, wait a minute. Why is that sitting out in the middle of that field like that? And I thought, no, I don't think I need that Syrian helmet that bad. Could be that not only there are mines around here, but it could be that thing is booby-trapped. So I decided I didn't want it. Well, on that same trip, when we were down by the Dead Sea, there was a ruined, burnt-out tank there, and there were actual live rounds of machine gun ammunition lying there, both in clips and individuals all over the ground. And I believe Jim Thornhill did pick up a few of those live rounds. I decided not to go near it and just leave it alone. Anyway, I'm just talking about some personal experiences because when we were there in 1966, only a few months before the 67 war, we knew that Egypt and the other nations were preparing for war. We were in Egypt, we were in Amman, Jordan, and we were in Lebanon. When we were in Egypt, we drove all the way to Suez. We drove past every kind of a military encampment. We saw hundreds of tanks and huge big field pieces, artillery, mobile artillery poking up into the sky. Just everywhere, evidence of large mobilization of Egyptian forces. Well, my dad and I had met a man named Adlai Muqtadi. He had come to us through other sources, I don't know just who. But he was the head of Jordanian Broadcasting, and Eastern Jerusalem had a large transmitter that reached pretty much all of the Middle East in Arabic as well as in English and in other languages. And we had negotiated to put the World Tomorrow broadcast on Radio Jerusalem. My dad felt that that was a tremendous breakthrough, a huge door to open up, to get our program broadcasting to Israel and the Middle East, because anybody could tune into it, even though it was in Jordanian territory. I left and was on a commercial airliner somewhere about halfway across the Atlantic. My dad had not departed yet because I was to meet him in England, and we were to go on down there together. And while I was halfway across the Atlantic, the 1967 Six-Day War broke out. And the Israelis, of course, captured the eastern part of Jerusalem, along with it, Adlai Muqtadi's home, which he still is bitter about to this day. I've seen it. It's about a three-story building perched on a road overlooking a steep valley. And he went to work as a supplier of oil rigs off of Saudi Arabia and other places, and he's a man that I think is quite well-to-do. He's visited us here in this country since that time. And when we were over there years ago, took the camera, and Mark and I went over there and did some interviews with Crown Prince Hassan. And the girl that my son had dated a little bit, who was an Arabic girl, and it couldn't go anywhere because of the religion. The parents wouldn't think of it going anywhere way back then, but they were pretty much attracted to each other. She was a lovely girl. She also happened to be the private secretary of either Hassan, I think Hassan himself, the Crown Prince. Yeah, that's right. She was the personal secretary to Crown Prince Hassan of Jordan. So, now I'm saying that to tell you this, that I've met people on both sides. I've been in Jordanian homes. I've been in the homes of doctors and people in politics. I met and interviewed Husseini, who died of a heart attack here only about a year or so ago. He was one of the leaders right next to Yasser Arafat. I never wanted to meet Arafat. I could have interviewed Hanna Ashoury, and I said, I don't want to interview this woman. You've seen her time and again. She is the only female spokesman for the Arabic cause. You see her time and again on television. Everybody in America, the Clinton administration urged it. Millions of our citizens believe it. President George Bush is pushing for it. Europe wants it. Everybody is insisting that the Jews return to their pre-1967 borders. Meaning, give the old city and half of Jerusalem to Yasser Arafat for his capital. Give the Gaza Strip, which used to belong to Egypt, but give it to the Palestinians. Give all the West Bank, including dozens of small cities with tens of thousands of beautiful, and I've seen them, beautiful stonework. They are so cool inside in the hot summer, and they're so warm inside in the cold winter. Our own offices in Jerusalem, where the one family, I won't mention their name, lived, and where I've eaten and enjoyed visiting with them when we had the office over there near Ramallah. And I mean, I'm talking about thousands of high-rise apartments just festooning the West Bank, where for all these years, since 1967, Jewish settlers from all over the world, from Yemen and Morocco, from Russia, from Saudi Arabia, from Europe, from the United States, have moved in there and bought them. Now, those are their homes. Every one of those villages feature shopping centers, restaurants, infrastructure, flushing toilets, bus lines, newspaper, radio, television. They are modern little towns, and they just dot the West Bank by the dozens. We're not talking, when we talk about settlements, a few people living in an old goatskin tent. We're talking about the actual remaking of landscape and the building of cities that has been going on since 1967. Over 30 years, 33 and more years. That's a long time. There have been youngsters born, grow up, and marry, and have children, and their children are growing up. We're getting into the third generation of people that have lived in these settlements. And our government, and all of Europe, and the United Nations, and the Pope, and everybody involved, expects the Jews to just kick those people out of those houses and give them to the Arabs. But the Arabs never improved that land. The contrast between Jordan and Israel was so shocking, I can't even tell you how shocking it was. Now, let me just give you, in essence, real quickly, what it would mean if the Palestinians receive a Palestinian state. What is a state? Well, a state means complete sovereignty. It means a nation that takes its place among other nations. It means that they would immediately be recognized by Russia, China, Iraq, Iran, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Indonesia, the Philippines, and hundreds more. Immediately. And they would also be recognized by the United States of America. The state of Palestine, at last. We've wanted it for so long. Except for 700 years under the Caliphate of Baghdad, even prior to World War II, when Transjordan became a separate nation, when Hashemite Arabs were given a land that they had never been given before, but were merely tribal Bedouin Arabs out in the desert, there had never been a hint or a suggestion that there ever be a Palestinian state. All during the time from the unilateral declaration of Israel in 1948 until the 1967 war and the loss of that territory, there had never been a demand by the Jordanians or by the Palestinians against the Jordanians. Why don't you Jordanians, King Hussein, let us have the old city and the West Bank for a Palestinian state? It had never been proposed. Egypt had the Gaza Strip. The Arabs living in the Gaza Strip never proposed, why don't you make us, Egypt, a Palestinian state? Never been proposed. The Arabs living in Syrian-controlled territory in the Golan Heights didn't say to Syria, why don't we have a Palestinian state? Because, you see, Syria possessed the Golan Heights, Jordan possessed the West Bank, and Egypt possessed the Gaza Strip. And there was never any movement among any of those Arab governments for there to be a Palestinian state. Only after their fourth or fifth unsuccessful onslaught by five combined Arab armies against little Israel, trying to exterminate them to the last man, woman, and child, and then losing all that territory, did they say, we've got to have a Palestinian state. Now, I wish I had an hour to tell you how guilty Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt are. They are as guilty as sin. There have been hundreds of thousands of Arabs kept in those rotten, fetid, squalid camps on the southern Lebanon border and along the Jordan River until a vast civil war broke out in about 1970-71, and the Desert Legion of the Jordanians actually had to drive the Palestinians out of Jordan, and they found refuge up in Lebanon because they became such a political and a military threat to King Hussein that he was afraid they were going to overthrow him and take over Amman, a bunch of guerrillas out of these refugee camps, and make it their state. And Hussein survived only by having his own armed forces in virtually a civil war drive the PLO and all their forces out. They finally had an enclave in northern Jordan for a while, but eventually they succeeded in driving them out of there as well. Go check it out if you'd like to read Jordanian history. Now, the incredible hypocrisy of all of this is just unbelievable, but I'll try to wrap this up and get to the biblical meaning of it in a minute. If it becomes a state, it means it can form alliances. It can sign pacts and treaties. It means that the Gaza Strip airport will become an international airport. Now, an international airport will receive flights from where? Anywhere in the world. Baghdad, Tehran, China, Russia, Europe, anywhere. What do those airplanes carry? The freighters carry anything they can pack in them. A great big Russian Antonov can carry about 3 to 4 tanks every time it lands. How many aircraft could land there in a day? Several hundred. Who would interdict them? Who would stop them? Who would search them? No one. They are sovereign. There's no interdiction. There's no stopping them. Is there stopping any of air freight that comes into LaGuardia or Kennedy? No way. They would not only be instantly recognized, but they would immediately apply for full membership instead of observer status in the United Nations and perhaps even begin to lobby for a place on a Security Council. These would become international ports. There would be an international port in Gaza so that ships, the last time one of them tried it, you know, they interdicted it at Aqaba. And here from Iran were tons upon tons of rockets and mortars and machine gun and small arms ammunition and everything. And that was a great big flap because they've now actually proved by documents they've discovered since they broke into Arafat's compound that Arafat himself knew about it and was complicit in all of this. They've even got his signature on documents where he actually was approving terrorist acts. And this nation seems to want to champion. Well, it's not really officially. It's not saying much about it right now. It kind of reversed itself a little bit in that regard with regard to Arafat and hoping that someone will come along and succeed him. And yet, it is saying, don't hurt him, don't kill him, don't capture him, leave him alone. But there's no indication in the next couple of days that Colin Powell is even going to meet with him. A new state of Palestine would then represent what? It would represent a sacrosanct base within Israel for additional terrorism and to form its own army, its own navy, its own air force, its own intelligence, covert operations and intelligence agencies, and could operate just like any other state in the world. Is it any wonder to you that some people in Israel fear the creation of a Palestinian state? Now, to go ahead real quickly to the end, let's go to Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verse 1 to 4. I read to you, and you can see in Luke 21, 20, Jerusalem encompassed with armies. In Luke 21, 21 to 24, Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles. Now, Jerusalem is not trodden down of the Gentiles right now. Yes, there is an Arab quarter, just like there's an Armenian quarter and a Jewish quarter and a Christian quarter in the old city. but it's largely about 98% Jewish. It's not being trodden down by the Gentiles at a Goyim. So, behold, the day of the Eternal comes, and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women's ravished. And half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city. We're being told that at the time of the second coming of Christ, which is after the tribulation, after the heavenly signs, and at the conclusion of the day of the Lord, Jerusalem will once again be a divided city, half and half. Now, on the other hand, we're told in Daniel, the 11th chapter, verses 41 to 45, that he, the beast power, the northern power that is going to come in there, will enter into the glorious land. And it says that he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, verse 45. So that shows a European power is going to occupy Jerusalem. So if the Gentiles are going to tread down Jerusalem and a European power occupy Jerusalem, that could be one and the same thing. Because they are Gentiles. They're not necessarily Arabic. It does not mean a Palestinian state has to take place there in order for this prophecy to be fulfilled. But it does show that only half of the city will go into captivity at the great battle that erupts just before Jesus Christ himself comes. So I've said for decades to watch Jerusalem that it's the absolute key, the pivotal point, the flash point that is going to start World War III. How close are we now to events just like that? I'll tell you, the stupidity to some of these people that call in and say they think we ought to send troops over there Now, you just stop that, you Palestinians and you Israelis. We Americans are just going to come over here and send our troops. Of course, that was probably some mother who doesn't have anybody in the armed services, and she wouldn't have been quite so stupid. But they call in and make those statements, and it just annoys me to death because it shows the utter lack of grasp of geography, of history, of biblical prophecy, of the knowledge of what really is happening in the world and what is going to happen in that part of the world and a part of the average person on the street. They're just completely ignorant. And what you don't know, you don't know that you don't know it. So they're not about to look it up and find out either. But you know, and I know, and the question is, are we doing what Jesus Christ says we are to do in the light of all that we know? And that is that he says that we are like chamberlains, or we have been given the wardship over his house, and the house is the work and the church. And he said that blessed is that servant whom when his Lord shall come, he shall find so doing, that we are to watch and we're to pray always and to pray more. We're to forsake not the association or the fellowship of ourselves together as we see the day approaching, but even increase in it. We are to actually increase in love and personal consideration and concern, and we're not to go to sleep and become lethargic and just live with all that's happening so that it grinds away on you to the point you're weary of it. You just had it up to here. You hear it every day. You don't want to hear it anymore. And so you just become uninvolved. It's like something, you know, people are jaded, I think, because of television and the movies. And there's a kind of an unreality about it. You see it on television, and it's like it's not quite real. I've heard, and I've chided myself, I wish that I had done what I almost did and didn't, and I've regretted it ever since. When I was at Norfolk a little over 6 months ago for my ship reunion right after 9/11, I was there on the 14th, and I had a rental car, and I was only like an hour and a half or 2 hour drive from Washington, D.C., and from New York. And I should have just gotten in the car and gone up there, at least driven by. Because I've heard so many people say that no matter what you saw on television, when you go there and you see that incredible destruction and the vast scope of it, acres and acres and acres of what used to be tall, proud buildings just lying in rubble, that it has an impact that television could never give you. So I wish to this day that I had taken that opportunity, but I didn't. And even to this day, people who go to New York, go up there and walk up on a scaffold and look at that vast scene of desolation, it has an impact like nothing else could. So let's us be involved as much as we're supposed to be spiritually and not be lethargic and go to sleep and switch and be unaware of what's happening.